This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A somewhat fictionalized version of Reuben Hurricane Carter's life is now showing in movie theaters, starring Denzel Washington. With me is Carter himself and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Carter. Hirsch is a former staff writer for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. In 1966, when Carter was a top contender for the middleweight boxing crown, he and a friend were arrested for a triple murder in a bar in Paterson, New Jersey. They maintained their innocence but were convicted. Carter was sentenced to life. In 1976, the New Jersey State Supreme Court overturned his conviction on grounds that the prosecutors withheld material evidence from the defense. But Carter was reconvicted in a second trial later the same year. His conviction was overturned by a federal judge in 1985. Now Carter is the executive director of the Canadian-based Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. I asked Carter to describe the night he was arrested.
I was on my way home, and John Artis, a young man, was on his way home, and I was passing in his direction. And he asked me for a lift home. And as we were going home and was stopped at a red light, waiting for the traffic light to change, a police car pulled up alongside of us. And when this police car pulled up alongside of us, other police cars converged on the scene. And we were transported down through the cities of Paterson, New Jersey, until we arrived at a place where there were 75 to 100 people milling in the streets around this tavern called Lafayette Bar and Grill, which we had never known existed before. And we were taken out of the car, brought to the hospital, where one of the people who had been shot in this bar was still alive and still conscious, and he had been shot himself. And we were placed in front of this man and asked if we were the ones who shot him. The man looked at us, studied us, and said, "No, these are not the people who shot me." And we were then taken to the police station, held for 17 hours, given lie detector tests, passed the lie detector test, and finally, 17 hours later, we were released. We find out then that four people have been shot in the Lafayette Bar and Grill by two other people. Two other people whose descriptions were two tall, light-skinned men, 5'11 to 6 feet tall, weighing 170 to 190 pounds, with pencil-thin mustaches. And from that moment on, we went to court, fearing for our lives, being tried for the death penalty of these murders, and being tried by no evidence existed at all. All the evidence that existed, there was no police weapons. There was that's the extent to which I know about anything else that happened on June 17th, 1966. That's it.
James Hirsch, from your reading of the record, what do you think convinced the jury that Carter was actually guilty?
Well, basically, the state pinned its case on the eyewitness testimony of two petty criminals and admitted liars who were in the vicinity of the crime scene that night. They were in the midst of breaking into a warehouse. And these two individuals testified at the trial that they saw Reuben Carter and John Artis fleeing from the crime scene. Only later, after the trial, was it revealed that they gave their testimony in exchange for promises of leniency from the prosecutors. And ultimately, both witnesses recanted their testimony and acknowledged that they had perjured themselves.
Reuben Carter, did you feel that the police were out to get you?
Oh, I didn't feel the police were out to get me. I knew the police were out to get me, and they were out to get a lot of different people at that time. It just so happened that Paterson, New Jersey, was my hometown, It just so happened that I was the number one contender of the world. I was the hometown celebrity. Some people didn't like that. I lived in the suburbs. I was making over $100,000 a year. I had custom-made cars. I had custom-made clothes. I had horses up on the mountain. I had yachts in the in the ocean. I was at the peak of my career, married, beautiful three-year-old daughter. There were a lot of people in Patterson who didn't like that, who didn't like the fact. And plus, I was arrogant. No question about it.
You had said things that had really inflamed, I think, the police.
I didn't say things. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I didn't say things that inflamed the police. I said it was the truth that inflamed the police. Not the things that I said, but the truth of what was being said. Because each time there was a disturbance going on in the cities throughout the United States, and there were hundreds of them going on all at the same time, where black people were being shot down in the streets by the police department, being shot down all over the country simply because we wanted to vote, simply because we wanted to go to school and be treated equally, simply because we no longer wanted to be segregated, riding on the back of buses and not being able to eat here, sleep here, and work here. We wanted that to be stopped. And the police, the security, internal security forces of the United States did not wish that to happen. And that is why the hometown of Patterson, New Jersey was able to get rid of me on this flimsy, flimsy false indictment.
I think also, Terry, it's important to remember what Reuben was doing professionally at the time. He wasn't just a prize fighter, but he had developed this whole persona of the hurricane. He was bald. He had this thick goatee. He would come into the ring scowling, and he looked menacing. Reuben scared people, particularly white people, and he was a very outspoken that blacks should use whatever means necessary, including violence, to defend themselves.
Against violence.
Against violence. And as a result, you know, Reuben was under surveillance even before he was arrested for these murders, and Reuben is correct that he was a target, in part because just of the climate of the times, and in part because of who Reuben was.
Reuben Carter, even though you maintained your innocence and fought for appeals and an overturn throughout your years in prison, you didn't try to just accept the prison rules that were handed to you and be compliant with them in the hopes of proving a model prisoner.
I felt as though, and I don't mean to cut you off, but when you say something, it kind of sort of triggers something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You said model and didn't become a model prisoner. Well, I didn't see why I would become a good prisoner when I hadn't been a bad civilian. That didn't make any sense to me at all. And therefore, I refused to accept someone's imposition of guilt. I refused to accept the government of the United States laws that black people are not human. I refused to accept that, even though the law of the land is that black people are only 4/5 of a human being. That's what the law of the United States is. I refused to accept that, too. You see what I mean? Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. So I was going to say, what were some of the prison rules that you refused to go along with?
Every single one. Every one. I would not. You see, if you had a pie that you baked and you sliced that pie and you find that one part of that pie is poison, then that entire pie is also poison because it's all made out of the same ingredients. And therefore, to walk into that prison and to accept, adopt, or to go along with any of its rules, any of them at all, would be to accept the prison system, would be to accept the mantle of guilt that was wrongfully imposed upon you. You see, a lot of people in prison today standing on the wrong side of the law, not because they went astray, but because the law, having been placed in the wrong hands, strayed from the right path. And that's exactly what happened in this case. It was the law.
So, go ahead.
Reuben turned on its head the traditional relationship between inmate and prison. Normally, a prisoner is able to reduce his sentence time or get parole through some combination of rehabilitation and good works in prison. Well, Ruben refused to go through that process because in his mind, he was not a criminal. And so he refused to wear prison clothes. He refused to eat prison food. He refused to do prison jobs. And as Ruben said, I will not help my keepers keep me kept. And also, he refused to see the prison psychiatrist who had to, in effect, tell the warden that the inmates had been rehabilitated in order to receive parole. In a way, this was a high-risk strategy for Ruben because if the conviction was never overturned, he stood no chance of ever winning his freedom. But it also showed that Ruben was a man of principle. He would only win his freedom the right way, not in any way that would suggest he agreed with the prison sentence to begin with.
But Ruben Carter, weren't you punished for refusing to play by the rules and even sent to solitary?
Well, solitary confinement was the punishment from day one, because since I would not relinquish my civilian clothes or jewelry or shave my beard or become a non-person, a number, a thing, then they had to get me out of the sight of the rest of the prisoners. So they put me in solitary confinement. And solitary confinement in Trenton State Prison, one of the worst prisons on the whole planet Earth, solitary confinement was under the ground in total darkness, no running water, no sanitary conditions, nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's where they put people to break them. They place human beings in those conditions to subdue them, to destroy them. And that's what's going on throughout these prisons in the United States today. They are destroying people, and they are proliferating unchecked.
So how come your stays in solitary didn't make you think, well, maybe I should start obeying the rules because this is just too horrible to endure?
I am not a criminal. I do not capitulate with criminals. I could not do that. Simple as that. Could not do it.
So how long?
And that's why, and you know, that's why there's so much crime proliferating in our communities all around it. Because we will not stand up to it. And we will not hold accountable those people who are committing those crimes. Because what is sending an innocent person, what else is sending an innocent person to prison if not kidnapping?
How long were you in solitary confinement?
More time than I care to remember. Years and years, intermittently broken up from time to time.
Well, part of the reality of solitary confinement is that there is no time. There is no schedule. It's not, you know, you see the sunrise and the sunset. As Ruben said, under the ground. So it's very hard for Ruben to know exactly how many weeks or months he was actually down there.
James Hirsch, can I ask you to just kind of sum up for us the steps along the way to the final overturning of the charges, how many appeals there were and so on?
Sure. Well, of course, Ruben's first conviction was overturned in 1976 by the state Supreme Court, which ruled that he had been wrongfully convicted based upon withholding of material evidence. Ruben was then retried and reconvicted a second time. And Ruben spent 9 more years in prison until finally in 1985, a federal judge overturned the second conviction based upon, once again, the prosecutors withholding material evidence and also prosecutors making an unconstitutional appeal to racial prejudice.
Ruben Carter, you were released for about 8 or 9 months after your decision was overturned before you were reconvicted.
In 1976, yes.
Yeah, and then when you returned to prison after
yes.
that brief stay outside, it sounds yes. like you changed a little bit. You gave up law books for philosophy
oh, yeah.
books and spiritual books. What
oh, yeah.
what was that change?
That change was because for the first 10 years that I was in prison, I dedicated myself to writing my autobiography. And so our story, the real story, will be told from our point of view, because when we went to court, there was no search for truth there. There was just a game. It was and the prosecutor and the defense attorneys and the lawyers, they were all just playing games there. And so I was determined to get my story out. So for the first 10 years, I wrote my autobiography as well as studied the law and practiced law in the courts of the state of New Jersey. And after that, and I was able, with the help of a lot of people, I was able to have the trial overturned, the conviction overturned, and get a retrial. Well, after the retrial, I saw that I was back in prison and the law would not do me any good. So I gave away all my law books and said, I got to find something beyond the law, find something above the law, something that could control the law. I cannot control the law, obviously. So I got to, because the law, it is the law or the people whose hands the law was placed in that were my enemies. So I had to find something above them, something above them. And that's when we begin to turn the prison into an unnatural laboratory of the human spirit. That's when we begin to search for self, search for myself, search for something above the truth, something that can bring the truth under control.
What books did you find?
Oh, there were many books. I mean, we could sit here and talk about books all day. We're talking about Krishnamurti. We're talking about Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha. We're talking about Uspensky, Gurdjieff. Just on and on. Those kind of books, metaphysical books, spiritual books. I studied every religion on the face of the earth, every culture on the face of the earth, every language on the face of the earth. I was trying to find something that everybody always talked about, this great thing that everybody was always talking about. There had to be a shred of truth somewhere behind it. And I was so determined to survive that prison system and bear witness to it that I had to find something beyond myself. And that search was a miraculous search. And that's the search that Jim Hurst's book talks about. What, the miraculous journey of Reuben Carter. Yes.
What about now? Do you consider yourself to be practicing any religion or spiritual discipline? Do you still read that kind of book?
No, I don't. I don't, as a matter of fact. But I do not have a religion. And it all depends on what one understands by religion. To me, religion is a religious mind, a mind that is awake and not asleep, a mind that is conscious and not unconscious, a mind that respects life to the ultimate, a mind, a body, and a soul that comes into agreement with the continuation of life on earth and in total disagreement with the destruction of life on earth. And we're not talking about the entities in which contains that life. We're talking about life, period.
James Hirsch, can you tell us a little bit more about the decision of the federal judge in 1985 who overturned the charges, overturned the conviction against Reuben Carter? What were the main things he cited in his decision?
Well, first of all, it should be noted that the judge, H. Lee Sarakin, received what's known as a writ of habeas corpus. Very few writs are granted by federal judges. It requires a federal judge to evaluate a state court conviction and overturn it. About 3% of those applications are granted because federal judges are far more inclined to rubber stamp the status quo than overturn the conviction. Reuben's case was particularly problematic because it was such a complicated case. The legal proceedings had gone on for almost 20 years at that point, and the motion itself had an appendix of 20,000 pages. Reuben and his lawyers were fearful that no judge would actually sit down and read the case and untangle it. Fortunately, just by the luck of the draw, they did get Judge H. Lee Sarakin, who was known as an outspoken liberal judge who was very sympathetic towards
I don't
civil
think,
rights,
Jim,
toward civil rights rights issues. And so Sarakin was willing to read the case. And once he did, he saw not only were the convictions wrongful, because, as I said a moment ago, because the evidence had been withheld, and because the prosecutors made an appeal to racial prejudice, but he actually saw the facts of the case and that they did not support the conclusion of guilt. A judge is not supposed to rule on the innocence or guilt of the defendant, just whether the conviction was lawful. But Sarakin saw that not only was the conviction unlawful, but that Reuben was also innocent.